Good morning. We are continuing our series called Church on Fire. And I noticed that I accidentally made a typo in the footnotes, so I called it Church of Fire in the footnotes. And it's not a Johnny Cash reference. Oh, that would be pretty funny. I fell into a burning church of fire. It's probably a good evangelism method, but it's not the title of this series. We're looking at the book of Acts because Acts is an amazing book that's going to challenge us. It has just amazing things of God's Spirit. I've said before, and I think I'll say it over and over again, that it's called the Acts of the Apostles, but really it's the Acts of God. It's amazing to see what God does through these people who are just sold out because they're living out the resurrection. And we saw a couple weeks ago, Acts chapter 2, which is one of the most powerful passages in all of Scripture, where the tongues are able to be understood by everybody there. Peter, who's just been this reclamation project, stands up and preaches this sermon, and at the end of it, it says 3,000 people were added to their number that day, and really, churches have been trying to replicate that day ever since. I mean, this amazing moment when God's Spirit is on everybody there, and people connect to this new church, this new dramatic group of believers. And Luke is writing the book of Acts, and if I'm Luke, I'm trying to think of, like, what do I do next? I mean, after that huge pinnacle, 3,000 people, this huge miracle, what do I write next? What would you write? Don't cheat, all right? Many of you are like, I already know, but don't cheat. If you're writing this and you're trying to, like, kind of build the momentum, do you go A, with a cripple getting healed? I got slides for this, Chris. You can go A, with a cripple being healed, B, Peter and John dramatically standing up to the authorities, or C, a story about the church gathering. What do you think? Do you go A? If you're writing it, you might know what it's there already, but if you're writing it, do you go with, like, a cripple being healed, kind of showing this other miraculous thing? Do you go B, Peter and John standing up? Got several. Do you go C? You're all cheaters. Because that's what Luke ends up doing. And it's kind of interesting because he's going to talk about these other things right there in the beginning of Acts 3. He talks about this cripple being healed. He's going to talk about Peter and John standing up to the authorities really throughout the book of Acts. I mean, he is going to come and eventually talk about those things. But he starts by talking about the church, which, if you kind of are just reading through it, you might think, oh, that's kind of a boring turn, you know, not with 3,000 people being saved or not someone being healed. He just talks about the church. And on its surface, it might look a little bit boring, but if you really dive into what happens here, it's absolutely beautiful. We're probably going to study it for the next, at least another week, maybe one more after that, because it's absolutely beautiful. Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by all the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold their property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added daily to their number those who were being saved. So it gives us a picture here of what the first church looked like. It goes from, like, 3,000 people being saved to this very intimate picture of what these believers looked like. And it's really interesting when you just let yourself be challenged with it a little bit, because it's like, because they have claimed Jesus as Lord, because they believe that Jesus has been resurrected from the dead, it's like they can't see their stuff the same anymore. They're just sharing what they have. The resurrection has direct implications for how they view even their possessions. And they give, and they give, and they give. They see ownership a different way than we do. The topic of ownership is interesting when you think about it from the American perspective. The book that I'm reading about this talked about how 350 years ago in America, Native Americans were here. And Native Americans didn't have a really strict understanding of land ownership. The idea was kind of that the spirits owned it, and you couldn't really own a plot of land. A quote about that said, long before the first European settlers came to America, Indians had developed an advanced economy. Indian tribes traded extensively with each other, and many had some form of money. None, however, had any institution like the land title of the Europeans. And so Europeans come and they're like, what, you guys don't own that? You don't, like, everyone gets a plot of land? They don't really understand that. Now it's like a huge part of our society. Many of us will never own something in California because it's so dang expensive. But when they show up, the Europeans come with this idea of land. What, you guys don't have, like, titles to the land? You don't figure it out and split it all up? And now that's a huge part of our society, right? So we go from a place where you don't own the land really at all to fast forward to where we are now. Just a couple years ago, Subway was trying to copyright the word footlong. The word footlong. And Subway, what they started doing is they sent cease and desist letters to little mom and pop shops who had had footlong items for like 40 and 50 years. They sent one to Coney Island Drive-In in Brookfield, Florida. And this place had been selling a footlong hot dog for 40 years. And they sent a letter and said, you must remove immediately all references to footlong in association with your sandwiches or other items. Hey, can you own a system of measurement? Do you own everything that is a foot long? How is that possible? And so for these little shops, it's like, what are you supposed to do? Start selling 11-inch hot dogs? Or 13-inch? I don't really know what you're supposed to do. And the ironic thing about all this is Subway footlongs are not really a foot long usually. Chris, go to the picture. That is not even close. That's not my picture, actually, but I found that online. It's not even close. They started sending out these threatening letters, and eventually they kind of dropped it a little bit because they realized, what are you supposed to do? Are you really supposed to tell everyone who has sold a footlong thing for all this time that they can't do it anymore? Can you really own a system of measurement? So 350 years ago, there was an idea that even the land wasn't really ours, and now we're trying to own words. There's a whole section of law called intellectual property. That's the ownership of ideas and abstract thoughts, and people are going to go to court tomorrow fighting over ownership of ideas and words. And we've come a long way understanding ownership. We think that everything is ours, and we hold on to our possessions pretty tightly. But here in the book of Acts, you see, because of what Jesus has done, because of his resurrection, these people see their possessions differently. And really, it's not a new idea or a new concept. Throughout the Old Testament, you see this idea that's presented. In the Psalms, for example, Psalm 24 says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. If we could just learn that. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. The world and all who live in it. For he founded it on the seas and established it on the waters. In Deuteronomy 8, 17 and 18, it says, you may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands has produced this wealth for me. But remember the Lord your God, for it's he who gives you the ability to produce wealth, and so confirms his covenant which he swore to your ancestors, as it is today. In the Old Testament, it is presenting this idea that even when you go to work, and yes, you work hard, you have a great work ethic, you work 50, 60-hour work weeks, and yes, you're doing that, but even with that, who gave you the ability to have that job? Who gave you the connections? Who gave you the ability to keep that job? Who gave you the ability to have this wealth? Who gave you the ability to have all this stuff? So when you own things, the Old Testament is saying, don't be confused. Because even the ability to produce wealth, the stuff we have, is a gift from God. And what you see in the book of Acts is that because of what Jesus has done, they hold their possessions like that. They understand that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And so as they gather, they say, oh, do you have a need? And they share. They radically share. They radically give. It sounds kind of boring on its surface, maybe. It's maybe not as good as a cripple being healed or Peter and John standing up dramatically to authorities. This is a radical passage. That for the church to be the church, we come together, we share We hold our possessions in a certain way because we understand the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, even the jobs that we have. We're blessed beyond measure to have them. So possessions must be held in a certain way. Thing is, it's so easy for us to hold possessions differently, especially in our world, as we talked about. Ownership is so important. There's a book I read recently called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are by Rob Walker. And he did some research for this book. He went around and asked people if they were aware when they were being marketed to. If they were savvy enough to know, like, yeah, I'm being marketed to at this point. Guess how many people said they were savvy enough to know? 77% of Americans said, you know, I know that dumb guy over there, he doesn't know when he's being marketed to, but I'm a little slicker than that. I know just a little bit better. And I got to be honest, I would put myself in the 77% too, and you probably would too. Because you know when you're being marketed to, or you think you do. But then why do companies spend billions and billions of dollars every year marketing to us? Is it just because of the 23% that's dumb enough to fall for it? At least those people were honest, right? At least they're like, yeah, I do. Why do they spend so much trying to sell their products? Because it works. Also, as he did this study, he found that 66% of Americans said they are better critical thinkers than their peers. At least that one's close to 50, right? That one, at least, like, they're like, yeah, I know a lot of people who are better critical thinkers than me. At least that one is, they're getting a little bit more honest. But Rob Walker, the reason why he wrote this book is because he had been a wearer of Converse shoes for 30 years, and he was really proud of that fact because he didn't go with, like, the big trends of Nike and go with everyone else, like everyone, all the big athletes and all the people who try to sell you Nike. So he was really, really proud of the fact that he wore Converse. He was like a different guy, away from the crowd, away from everyone else, all the other people that just follow through and listen to all those marketing ploys. But then he had this horrible crisis of conscience when Nike bought Converse 10 years ago. And he had this horrible crisis because he's like, well, what am I supposed to do? And he said this about this experience. He said, but why really did I feel so strongly about a brand of sneaker? Any brand of sneaker. I know why I rejected the Swoosh. That's Nike for anyone who's never been marketed to before. And Air Force Ones, I'd feel like a brand zombie. But what I suddenly couldn't reconcile was my belief that I could project my individuality through some other brand. Isn't this true of us? There's probably parts in your life or possessions that you have that make you feel like you're different than everyone else. So he said he had this moment when he realized that my unique wasn't really that unique. And this product, this Converse that made me feel so individual and made me feel like I'm just bucking this trend, it made me feel like such an individual person. In reality, this product just made me feel that way. But it wasn't true. We can hold our stuff so tightly, whatever it is, and make it feel like this is the thing that makes me me. This possession that I have is the thing that makes me who I am. And I'm going to put that above anyone or anything else. It's easy for our stuff to become part of our identity. And in the end, the problem with this is that thing actually owns you. It's not the other way around. That thing actually owns you. If you cling to stuff, possessions too tightly, they can easily own you. And so for this early group of Jesus followers, they held their possessions in a certain way. They thought that the earth was the Lord's and everything in it, so they held their possessions in a certain way. Because they believed what they believed about Jesus, they believed that this was the earth was the Lord's and everything in it. And so they held their things in a certain way. The word that the Bible, I think, would use for this is generosity. That they were generous people. And in the New Testament, Jesus describes people as having a good eye or a bad eye. And when he talks about it, he talks about it like the eye is the lamp of the body. So the way that you see your stuff, the way that you're either generous or not, doesn't just affect a little bit here or there. It doesn't just affect your stuff or doesn't just affect your money. It affects everything. Jesus says it affects the way that you view the world. You ever thought about the fact that we say things like, I can't believe I didn't deserve it, but he gave me a second chance. I really messed up at work, but my boss, she gave me another chance. Or I was kind of involved in this situation, but he gave me the benefit of the doubt. Or she gave me the benefit of the doubt about this situation. And it's not like someone in that moment wraps up a gift and then you open it, it's like, oh, the benefit of the doubt. Thank you so much for this. This is exactly what I needed. You can't really wrap up the benefit of the doubt or a second chance. But we use word like give because it connects to generosity. Someone who gives you a second chance or someone who gives you the benefit of the doubt, it is a gift. Don't get me wrong. It's because they're generous. Because your eye affects everything. You're good. Eye affects everything. One way that I think is a great test to understand if you're generous or not is, can you really celebrate with others? And when they get a promotion at work, or they're able to buy that house, or they're able to take that trip that you kind of have always wanted to, can you truly celebrate with them? I think that may be the best test to understand if you have a good eye or not. Because you kind of want it for yourself. You kind of want to take those pictures there. You kind of want to have that thing. You want to have that, but I think that might be the best test for understanding, do I have a generous eye or not? And really, as we talk about this, this isn't a conversation about just money and stuff. Really, it's about everything. Because I've known people who are very wealthy, who are very stingy. But I've also known people who are very wealthy who are very generous. And I've known people who don't have very much at all who are very stingy. People who don't have very much at all who are very generous, who would give you the shirt off their back. So this isn't about what paycheck you get or what kind of money you have or the things that you have or whatever that it is you have. It's about having a generous spirit no matter what you have and not letting your things define you. Because Converse doesn't make you you. And neither does that thing that you're holding on to so tightly. What's so fascinating is Luke tells us this about the church in Acts chapter 2. And then just a couple chapters later, he tells us this. Sorry, go a couple more slides. There we go. All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. One more slide. And God's grace was so powerfully at work in them. There were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. It's kind of like Luke is repeating himself, isn't it? This is just a couple chapters later, and there's not completely the same thing. He says some different things in these two passages, but it's like he has to remind us again and again, this is what the early church looked like. This is what the early church gave like. So people would come, they'd sell their homes and put what they had at the apostles' feet. And your question might be, Brian, is that what I'm supposed to do? And I would like to see that just once, especially with how much California homes cost, like to see that laid out in front of me. That would be pretty sweet. But I think the problem with these kind of passages is they're so far out there in our minds and they're just so foreign, especially with our understanding of ownership. It'd be so hard. And so we look at this and say, I can't possibly give everything. So we don't give anything. generously. So we let those kind of ideas just kind of exist outside of us, and it's kind of a nice idea that the early church did, but I can't give everything, so I'm not going to give anything. Now, as we look at this passage and think about this, we're going to think about it for a couple weeks, like I said, at least. What I'd like you to do this week is just have a conversation and ask someone this question. Go ahead and go to the next slide. What stuff owns me? And ask that to your kids. That might be a good way to start. Ask that to your spouse. That's an even better way to start, maybe. Ask that to someone who knows you really well, someone that you spend a lot of time with. What stuff owns me? It's a very simple question, but you might get an answer that you don't want to hear. This passage, I think both of these passages are just telling us that the early Christians, they viewed their stuff in a certain way. And maybe for us, God's call on us isn't to sell all that we have and come lay it here at the elders' feet or whatever, but maybe God is just calling you to take a step, to learn to have a more generous eye, and to think about what stuff owns you. Because it's easy for us to start to buy into the lie that Converse makes us us. Or whatever it is that you might fill in the blank. But in the end, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And it's not just about money and not just about possessions. It's about sharing life together. I wanted to have James come up. James, if you could come up. He and I have talked about how much we enjoy leading when I preach and when he leads singing. How much we enjoy doing it on days like this where we've had the fellowship time together, because it kind of makes a difference in the room from the very get-go as people come in here. Why do you think that is, James?
Well, you come in and you share together to start the day, and you continue to share as you come into this room. It's just, it's kind of a natural thing. It's my personal belief that this is what we're supposed to be doing. You know, is sharing everything, whether it's conversation as opposed to I'm going to sit down as this individual in this class and I'm going to learn me some good stuff here. But we come and we share a meal. We do these things we enjoy together. We come in here and we praise this God that we all love together. It's just an absolute difference. I can see it on your faces when you walk in if you've eaten over there.
Part of it is you're full.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Something has been satisfied. But you've also shared with one another, you know, whether it's your joys. That's joys and trials when they go together. Not your jowls. Regardless, like that sharing process is so incredibly powerful. We're all part of one another. We're all part of God, and God is part of us. And so when we open that up and we open ourselves up, He's going to work through us powerfully. And it's just obvious. It's obvious to me. I get so excited when there's going to be a breakfast. I get so excited if I'm leading that Sunday because I know that I can come in and say, hey, we're going to sing this song you've never heard before, and everybody just throws it down and rolls and sings praise. It's a beautiful blessing to everyone, to me and to you and to Brian. And mm-hmm. Then he knows that you guys are going to stay awake.
It is. Yeah. It is nice. And we'll sing in just a minute, so you can stay up here.
I'll stay up here.
Yeah, it's always a powerful time when we share. And it gets back to it's not just about money; it's about sharing your joils. It's about
joils, y'all. You learned something new today.
It's about sharing that life. And in a lot of ways, we this morning acted like this church in Acts because the youth group and parents and volunteers brought all that great food. It was awesome, by the way. Good job on that. And so they shared with us, and we then shared with them. We are able to help give some money to help them go on this trip that's going to happen in a few weeks. So it's like this mutual sharing that happens, and there's just this energy that comes into the room because of that. And that's I wanted James to talk about that because it is such a powerful a powerful thing when, even if it's something kind of small in that way, when we start to share and have that understanding, it changes us even as we walk in here. So I want you to just kind of continue to think about this passage and just read it over several times this week, Acts chapter 2, 42 through 47. Just allow it to kind of get deep into your heart. And have that conversation this week. Ask somebody who's close to you, what is it that owns me? I know I'm already dreading having it myself. But ask that question, what stuff owns me? What stuff gets in the way of me and sharing this life more deeply with people around me? Because this passage shows us something that's definitely scary, but it's also so beautiful, isn't it? It's such a beautiful, beautiful passage. When people are coming together, they're sharing what they have, they're seeing needs, and they're giving to people who have needs. They're sharing radically. And it says, because of what outsiders see, the Lord adds daily to their number. Because people see it and they can't help but get involved. So ask yourself that question, what stuff owns me, and how you can be a deeper part of the community that we have here. Let's stand and worship together.